The invisible hand contains sensitive material that could threaten the safety of our contributors. To protect the identities of those involved, we will mostly be using first names or pseudonyms. Content warning. This series contains graphic audio relating to animal cruelty and some violent themes, which may be distressing to some listeners. These episodes are meant to be listened to chronologically. This is Chapter 1. Where you stand depends on where you sit.
I started reading a beautiful story to you, but it ended on a rather sad note. So today, we're going to read further, because we love stories that end nice and happily ever after, don't we? Yes, don't you like a story that ends happily?
We do.
We do. Now let's listen further.
At some point in my early schooling, I was taught the basics of colour theory. We sat on our chairs, or maybe on the floor, and learnt that red, blue and yellow are primary colours, and that blue and yellow combined makes green. Maybe we finger-painted on large sheets of paper and returned home with our hands a different shade. As I grew up, the presence of colour faded into the background. It made up the background, but it was significant. And if I did not recognise that consciously then, I knew it implicitly. Colour is everyday phenomena that shapes the way we think and feel. The colours a character is clothed in encourage us to trust or distrust them. A landscape that feels luminous at dawn may become ominous at dusk. Beyond the pigments, we ascribe colour meaning. Within that rudimentary understanding we learn at age 5, we are introduced to white and black, not just as colours or shades, but as concepts. Because you have to add black crayon, paint or pen to the backdrop of a white notebook, you think of black as a colour and you use it to define things, to create lines you don't want to cross when you're colouring in. But paradoxically, black is often thought of as the absence of colour or nothingness. White, which looks like empty space, is scientifically understood as all the colours that exist combined, the totality. The stories we are told, particularly the simple ones when we are young, can create a sense of truth that's black and white. This is how we are taught to see. But reality exists in shades of grey, and some realities are invisible. This is what I've learnt from the endangered white rhino. When I began this story, I didn't realise that a poaching war could render a vast hidden system suddenly visible, and that I was already complicit in it. My name is Georgina Savage, and this is The Invisible Hand. Chapter 1. Where you stand depends on where you sit.
Right.
Time for the first Ellie.
First Ellie, okay. Cool.
Ellie.
I'm in South Africa, here with my folks and my aunt and uncle. We're driving to visit my cousin Tam and her family.
I say $50 for the first giraffe. That's my favourite.
I was born in Johannesburg in South Africa in 1992, the same year a referendum was held to end the apartheid regime. The referendum was limited to white South African voters, like my parents. My parents had moved to Australia for work in the late 80s, where they had my brothers. When Nelson Mandela was released from prison and the ANC was unbanned, my folks decided to return with my brothers to South Africa. The political tides were turning and the vicious regime was ending. In 92, 2 months after I was born, they voted to end apartheid, and along with a sweeping majority of white South Africans, they won. When I was six, my parents, my twin brothers and I moved back to Australia, once again for my parents' work. I quickly lost my South African accent and assimilated into the Australian way of life in Sydney. Apart from the occasional trip to visit family, I haven't spent much time in South Africa since. Until now.
Wait, watch the little boy.
Shalala. Hello, Shalala.
Oh, there we go.
Hi, Pam. How are you? Oh, so good to see you. Thank you so much. This is gorgeous.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh. I don't know what I was expecting, but it was different.
Tam is my cousin, and I'm here because I'm making this documentary about her family. My parents and hers, my aunt and uncle, are here for the weekend. This project's a good excuse to get us all together.
Hi, Sophia.
Hi, Ben. Do you remember me?
Yeah.
Tam's got two kids, Ben and Sophia, with her husband, Greg.
Are you excited? Yeah. We're going to make a documentary. Oh.
They live here where Greg works, which is in the Kruger National Park, one of the largest game reserves in Africa. He's a section ranger here and leads a patrol of men and tracking dogs in Lower Sabi, which is the name of the section he's responsible for in the park. At the moment, their main role is to protect the endangered white rhino from extinction by poaching. It's the cause the whole family is behind. But more on that later.
So much. Cool. Okay, I'll be right back. Oh, Tam, it looks so nice in here.
The climate is subtropical. Summer days are hot and sticky. The rainy season is from October until April. It's January when I arrive. The land is mostly flat, but the grass is high and lush, peppered with marula and acacia trees. The chorus of native birds and insects is loud and unending, and it's not unusual to hear the call of lions or leopards at night. The whole atmosphere feels thick with aliveness. Quite the place to raise a family.
Dense forests, sweeping grasslands, and rolling deserts. The region of southern Africa is a natural marvel to behold. Within its boundaries lies one of the largest national parks in the world, the Kruger. The nearly 2 million hectare reserve, teeming with wildlife, takes its name from the third president of the South African Republic, Paul Kruger, who initially proclaimed the area a government wildlife park in 1898. It was formally dubbed Kruger National Park in 1926, in homage to the conservationist and champion of the Boer cause. What was first a space to limit hunting and protect dwindling animal numbers quickly became a tourist hotspot, with visitor numbers steadily rising to a staggering 1.8 million in 2019. Kruger generates roughly 80% of the entire government park network's 650 million rand tourism revenue. And it's obvious why. From the bat-eared fox to the butterfly bat, the warthog to the waterbuck, the hippo to the hawk eagle, the Kruger puts a dent in any nature lover's bucket list. Despite being of a comparative size to Israel, the low grass and sparse vegetation gives visitors an unobstructed view of the ferocious lion, nimble cheetah, domineering elephant, robust Cape buffalo, and the imposing rhinoceros. Spread throughout the park are lodgements, restaurants, cafeterias, gift shops, libraries, and even a 9-hole golf course. Long a jewel in white South Africa's crown, it too served as an edifice to apartheid. Despite the abolishment of segregation across the park in the late 80s, the latter description remains arguably apt. The Kruger.
Okay, so Kruger's quite a big deal. The crown jewel of South Africa, and where I'll be living for the next couple of months. Despite Tam being family, when I arrive on her doorstep, we're essentially strangers. We haven't spent much time together since I was in nappies. But I do have these memories of long, balmy afternoons spent in her backyard, swimming in their pool whilst our parents cook the braai.
We had an amazing childhood growing up, you know. Settled kids, happy, you know, the normal kind of white picket fence scenario.
Tam is short, has brown hair just below the shoulders, and my nose. She's quiet in big groups, but very chatty in smaller ones. She's a very sweet and sensitive nature, soft but opinionated. An intriguing combination. Her version of the white picket fence dream now is more of a large wire fence surrounding the property, aimed at keeping out wildlife and protecting the kids and dogs.
Well, I think it's an awesome place to have kids. I really do.
This is Greg, Tam's husband.
Got a fantastic garden, a pool, sand pits, swings, massive trees. So it's just, I mean, it's a kid's heaven. I think we're very fortunate. But it does come with sacrifices. You know, for example, we can't just take the kids for a walk outside the yard because obviously there's lions and elephants and buffalo and things walking around outside.
Greg's tall, really tall, a fact he's over people pointing out, and skinny. He has a sharp sense of humour and an unassuming vibe about him. He's the kind of person whose face transforms dramatically when they smile. Tam and Greg have been together for over 10 years.
Tam and I met at a wedding and we kind of hit it off. I just liked her demeanour. She was sort of a little bit shy, a little bit introverted. She came across as being sort of introspective and a little bit complicated, which maybe is things that I like in a person. You know, when you chatted to her, she was very engaging and, yeah, and sort of things developed from there.
How would you describe Greg?
I suppose he's a gentle giant, I'd say. But yeah, I suppose also quite like the whole bush. He was a down-to-earth person. He's just such a caring, loving, awesome person. Heart of gold. Yeah.
Would you say he's a softie?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, complete. I was quite surprised when the Rangers had opposite feedback because he is such a softie. But he can be, you know, if he has to be, but generally complete softie. Hardly ever raises his voice, you know, just calmly deals with stuff. He's the calming influence, yeah.
You gonna help me?
Yeah.
Do you wanna tell me what we're doing right now, Ben?
We're just going, like, to find, like, a nice place, like, over there.
But what are you, me and Sophia doing?
We're just standing in the back, the bucky.
Whilst I'm recording this, Ben is 8 years old. He's got sandy brown hair and bronze skin from playing outdoors. His knees are scraped and bruised.
What time of the year is it now?
January 2020. Woo!
He loves animals, is an avid bird watcher, and is obsessed with Technic Lego.
What was that, Sophia?
I'm still little and I'm five.
Yeah, you're still little and you're five, I agree.
Sophia is five. When you first meet her, she's shy, painfully so. But after a few hours, she warms up and her cheeky side emerges. She has long, flowing blonde hair and bright, piercing blue eyes. She adores her brother, but the two are competitive and can become rivals in an instant.
Ben, what's your favourite animal then?
A rhino.
A rhino's your favourite?
Yeah, white and black.
Really? Has it always been your favourite or has it just become your favourite over time?
It was always my favourite. Impala!
Impala, so beautiful. So Ben, what do you think about the fact that your dad works trying to save your favourite animal?
I think it will be fun.
You think it would be fun to be a ranger?
Yeah, and I want to be a ranger when I grow up.
Really?
Yeah.
So you got to get on to know all your tracks now.
Yeah. I want to grow up. I want to be a ballerina teacher.
You want to be a ballerina teacher? How about just a ballerina?
No.
And you want to be a ranger?
Yeah.
Why do you think you want to be a ranger? What would be the best part of it?
Tracking. Trekking would be my favourite.
Do you want to tell me what tracking is? Because I don't really know.
It's when the rangers follow the poacher's footprints.
The poachers? So you want to be a ranger that stops poachers as opposed to a ranger that is just looking for animals?
I want to track the bad poachers.
How do you think you'll feel if you were to catch one?
I'll feel happy. What do you want to be when you're a little bit bigger?
You know, I kind of want to be doing what I'm doing right now.
I'd be my dad. He is my hero.
What about your mom?
She's also my hero.
What about you, Sophia? Who's your hero?
I don't know.
The pair have a dynamic that reminds me so much of mine with my brothers. We pretty much have the same age gap between us. When considering the idyllic bush lifestyle that these kids are growing up in, it can be easy to forget the reason they're here and their proximity to a global crisis.
They've been roaming the earth for more than 50 million years. Today, the African rhino has more value dead than alive.
Poaching activity coming across our boundaries is relentless. It's daily.
South Africa's rhino population is under siege. Poachers are killing 3 a day to sell the horns.
High-stakes war against trafficking of something worth more than gold, cocaine, even diamonds. The coveted horn of the endangered rhino, part of a black market controlled by transnational criminal networks.
South Africa is fighting a losing battle against poachers. Experts fear the rhinoceros, prized for its valuable horn, could soon disappear, as the species almost did a century ago due to poaching.
Authorities in South Africa have revealed that more than 1,000 rhinos were poached in South Africa last year. A strong demand from Asia fueled a 50% jump in the illegal slaughter from 2012. The numbers have increased exponentially every year. Despite drone and foot patrols, poachers appear to stay ahead of the security forces.
As you can hear from these clips, this is an issue which has been extensively covered by mainstream media. The common narrative renders those who poach as villains, and the conservation teams tasked with protecting the rhino as dutiful saviours. But is this simplistic account just serving a larger cultural narrative? South Africa is home to 93% of Africa's estimated 18,000 near-threatened white rhinos and 39% of the remaining 5,000 critically endangered black rhinos, making South Africa's rhino crisis a global rhino crisis. This makes this country the epicentre of the rhino poaching world. Rhino horn has been highly prized by several cultures for over 1,000 years, and trade records suggest that the intercontinental trade in African rhino horn to the Far East has existed for centuries, with little or no hunting regulation in southern African nations during the 1800s. The exceedingly common southern white rhino subspecies was hunted nearly to extinction by European settlers, sport hunters, and opportunists cashing in on the rhino horn trade. By the 2000s, numbers of rhinos were back to a healthy level. But somewhere between 2008 and 2009, the number of rhinos being poached began rapidly increasing. According to Save the Rhino International, in 2007, 62 rhinos were poached, and in 2008, that number rose to 262. By 2013, it was considered a full-blown epidemic, with 1,123 rhinos poached that year alone. The crisis is ongoing, and the conservationists are tasked with fighting it. It is certainly a conflict. Some consider it a war.
There's always been poaching. There's always been rhino poaching. There's always been elephant poaching. There's always been snare poaching. So, you know, I think for a young person aspiring to be a game ranger, that was a sort of an attraction in that it was offered, you know, a certain amount of excitement and danger, you know, to what a ranger would be. And it always has been.
There's a glamour associated with the danger.
Glamour, definitely, definitely. But I think the onslaught that has occurred in the last 10 years has just taken it way beyond what anybody anticipated. And I never expected to be working in Kruger, fighting a fight like that we are fighting. But I'll take it any day. Bring it on. I'm sure. Scott! Attention!
This is the morning ritual the rangers do at 5:30 each day.
Right, dress!
One! To the line!
It's a paramilitary-type salute parade.
Eyes front! Open order, march!
One! One door!
Standard is... Cap off!
One! To the line!
People talk about a rhino war, and in many ways it probably is. It's not like we're going into combat on a daily basis. It's just that we need to be prepared for combat because it can happen and it does happen. So
it's almost like the anticipation of war as opposed to the constant barrage of war.
Yes, yeah. Being prepared both mentally and physically for that is vital.
The Ranger Corps really are involved in managing Kruger, the integrity of Kruger.
This is Ken Maggs. He's the head ranger for the Kruger National Park. In other words, he's a big gun. He manages the entire Ranger Corps and operations, including protection services, security, traffic control, access, and more. He looks like you'd imagine, silver white hair cropped, crisp, clean uniform, piercing blue eyes, tan skin from a life spent outdoors. He's about to retire.
The rangers are looking after the area integrity of the particular section they're looking after, which entails, at the moment, unfortunately, mainly anti-poaching activity.
What percentage would you say of their job is dedicated to that?
Well, at the moment, it's in the region of about probably 80%.
And so about 10 years ago, what would that ratio have been?
Exactly the opposite. So it would have been probably between 70 and 80% would have been conservation management, 20 and 30% would have been your law enforcement, anti-poaching. It's keeping the colleagues in the Ranger Corps extremely busy.
The Kruger is divided into four sections: south, central, north, and far north, each headed by a district ranger that reports to the head ranger of the park. Across those districts are 22 sections, each under the charge of a section ranger, who commands sergeants, corporals, lance corporals, and field rangers. All told, there are roughly 450 field rangers in the Corps, only one for every 43 square kilometres. They have their work cut out for them. Even with the help of two helicopters, drones, automated movement sensors, specialist tracking dogs, and a joint operations command, the increasingly militarised Ranger Corps is a tiny force defending a vast land. The strain of resources was made evident as the rhino crisis reached its zenith in 2014, with over 100 poached 2 months into that year alone. Respite came in March with the establishment of the Intensive Protection Zone, or IPZ, in a southern section of the park where poaching was rampant, made possible through the immense donations that funded training and improved intelligence gathering. The IPZ is spread across six sections. Lower Sabi is one of them, where Greg is the section ranger. Under him, a corporal and 14 rangers patrol and protect this threatened species.
We are here as conservationists. I joined the organisation as a conservationist. We've kind of moved and evolved now, really, because of the situation, into almost a paramilitary conservation force.
And how do you think people have gone coping with that transition? They got into this industry to protect animals and because they're passionate about conservation, and now essentially they're almost army figures.
I think some people have battled with it and will battle with it. Others have taken it in their stride simply because, you know, it's a means to an end to achieve your conservation mandate. The anti-poaching is also evolving, so we're becoming almost soldiers simply because poaching groups that you're dealing with now are also desperate and so therefore become more and more aggressive. You know, they come in armed, they're not scared to shoot back or shoot at you initially. And we've had a ranger was killed in 2018. You're always one step behind poachers simply because they have no rules. And we are governed by all the rules of the land. And of course, poachers not. So you always tend to be one step behind. Obviously, we're not as effective as we would like to be because a few years ago, we lost 827 rhino in a year. The next year, we lost 826. The following year, 662. And then 2018, 421. Last year, we were down to below one a day. So I think we ended up in the region of 320 or 330 odd. So
one a day still seems like so many to be losing, though.
If you ask me, you know, you're losing one a day, are you comfortable with it?
Tam and Greg wake at dawn every morning to get the kids ready. They're busy packing lunches and prepping breakfast.
Making some lunch for them, for the kids. Then I'll do some breakfast. No, they've got into the early morning a little bit better. They can, yeah, they do okay.
It's not unusual for Sophia and Ben to eat before heading off to school, with the sun rising over the plains.
Good morning, Ben.
Morning.
How are you?
Good. Look at the sun.
The sun? Is it coming up?
Yeah, look at the purple in the sky.
Oh, it's pretty,
Ben. You see what's up, huh?
What?
What is it?
Ellie's right there. Should we go have a look, Ben?
We're seeing elephants right at the waterhole at the end of our garden.
This is so cool.
Yeah, but now we have to keep quiet.
Sorry, it's fine.
It's something to get my head around, that the sight of a family of elephants just meters away from my morning coffee is business as usual for these kids. It feels almost effortless slipping into their wild Thornberrys type lifestyle.
Such a baby.
Coming from the hustle and bustle of London, where I live now, to record this documentary, I get a sense of what it must have been like to so dramatically shift gears from the city lifestyle they were pursuing in Cape Town to the one they live now.
Hello, Sophia. It's a little baby Ellie just like you.
Governed by the cycles of the wild just beyond their garden fence. And how different Sophia and Ben's lives would be if they hadn't made the move.
Hi.
Okay, kiddos, let's hit the road. Look out, the river's flanked so nicely, huh?
Usually Tam takes the kids to school, which is about a 45-minute drive from their house. Greg prepares for his work day. He has to wait to hear what poaching activity has occurred overnight, and his team has to be ready for anything. But today it's Greg's turn to drive the kids.
So, did you used to come to the Kruger a lot when you were a kid?
Yeah.
Is that sort of what built this love affair?
I think so, yeah. Well, that just... a large part of it used to come with my grandparents. Like, when I mean, even Sophia's age, I guess, they used to bring us. And I've still got sort of vivid snippets of memory, you know, from those trips. No, I've been coming here a long time.
Do you remember when you'd had a thought in your mind that you might want to be working in this area as an adult?
There's been nothing else that I thought I'd want to do that happened.
So even as a teenager, you were like, I'm going to go to uni and...
Even before a teenager, as a kid, I think maybe, probably around Ben's age, it's just like what I wanted to do. So, yeah, there was never an alternative. Just neither, oh, I could do that or I could do that. It's like, I wanted to be a ranger. I wanted to be a ranger. That was it. The actual conservation jobs, you know, wildlife management conservation jobs are actually very few and far between. Most people who have a love for the bush and endeavour to make a career in the industry end up sort of on the tourism side of it, either guiding or hospitality or lodge management or something like that. It's not many who are fortunate enough to actually get into the conservation management side of it. So it's just so competitive. There's so many people that
have the same dream as you.
The same dream, are as willing and as able, and so you just really got to force your voice to do it.
Some of the conservationists see their work not as a job, but as a calling. Being so invested is what keeps them dedicated despite how grueling it can be. When the phone rings, they have to be ready to move. I'm in my first week here when Greg gets a call.
A group of poachers have come in during the night. The tracks have been found by Crocodile Bridge rangers on Crocodile Bridge section. Becomes a Crocodile Bridge operation, so they'll take control of it. We'll, you know, support.
Crocodile Bridge is the section next to Greg's section, Loasabi. The teams often join forces in moments like this. It's considered a Crocodile Bridge operation because they discovered the tracks, which means Greg and his team are playing the supportive role. There is a chance that the poachers might have come into Greg's section.
So we're taking our dogs as well. We will just stand by and assist where necessary. Just looking where the tracks were found. If they were to change and move sort of change to a northerly direction, then they could very well possibly come into Loasabi.
And if they were to come into your section, then does it become a Loasabi operation, or is it still...
Yeah, no, then it becomes a Loasabi operation. We don't sort of take too much ownership. We just work together. Doesn't matter where the rhinos are. They're still, you know, our rhinos.
And at what point would either one of you sort of call for helicopter support?
When we get an indication that the tracks are very fresh and we're very close to the group, then we'd call the helis in. The Cockbridge team are coming up with their dog headlamp. They'll get going on those tracks. We've got to kind of throw all our resources at an opportunity like this.
The rangers are trying to figure out how far ahead the poachers might be, if they're still navigating toward a location, or if they've already succeeded in a hunt. The Crocodile Bridge team is coming up with their dog, which happens to be named Hitler.
Generally, the old hands, the experienced guys who would come in with sort of younger recruits, the younger guys learn the navigation and the hunting and the tracking and all that from the more experienced guys. But the guys, when they come in, they don't have maps on them. They have very simple cell phones, not smartphones, so they don't rely on any technology to navigate. They're using landmarks and, you know, memory, I guess. And descriptions, you know, they often, if you ask, where did you come in, what, you know, how did you come in, the way they explain it to you is, yeah, we, you know, we crossed a fence and then we walked towards the sun until we crossed over a dirt road and we aimed towards those hills in the distance or you know, that specific point. So that's basically, I think, how they navigate. It's just memory and knowing the areas.
The extent of the poaching issue has led to the militarisation of conservation efforts. This has been gradual, and given that law enforcement has always been part of the demand on rangers, an increased emphasis on discipline and tactics has been an easy reach for most. That said, the intensity and relentlessness of the new job description has far exceeded expectations and can be a strain on the teams. Ken, the head ranger you heard from earlier, frames the conservationist operation as a counterinsurgency campaign, which means they develop their approach based on changing behaviour from the poachers. The poachers are good at what they do. They are highly skilled bushmen.
You know, they're disciplined in the bush, very disciplined. They don't smoke, talk, make fires. They, you know, as I said earlier, they don't carry blankets and mosquito nets and pots and pans and to live in the bush. They're very good in the bush. You know, we see that in the number of animals that they've killed over time.
Lawless and unbound, the poachers are difficult to predict. But the rangers have resources at their disposal, such as helicopters and tracking dogs. The dogs have a tracking harness with a GPS collar, so the rangers can track from a laptop or a phone and can see exactly where the dogs are at any moment. This information is essential for strategizing.
This is very interesting. I remember in 2012, when they started poaching. I remember we were in patrol, we see some vultures, then we found that two rhino dead.
This is Javu. He's a talented dog handler who works for Greg as part of the Loasabi team. His dog is called Ben, not after Ben the boy, but he lives at the house too.
Then we go back and report to section ranger that ish. They started to kill the rhinos and we tried to follow the tracks. The thing is, there's grass and everything, so it's not easy to follow the tracks. So the corporal there said, this guy, it seems he's got the talent to follow the tracks. Why can't we try him to be a dog handler? Fortunately, they gave me Ben, that dog there, as you can see. I don't know how many poachers did I make it, but I think plus minus maybe even 50, 60.
But you've 50, 60 poachers that you've caught with Ben?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, with that dog. It's a very strong dog.
Yeah,
he knows me. When I work with him, he knows that, hey, this is my owner. He do everything that I want.
So how does a handler build a relationship with his dog or her dog?
Okay, yes. The main aim of the dog to work nicely with you is bonding. You must play with your dog, bathing the dog, grooming the dog, everything, so that it can bond you. After bonding, you can use him.
Can you tell me about the process of catching a poacher? Like, what does that look like? How does that work with you?
We go to the field, we find tracks, then they call me with a dog. Tracks of people's.
And so you get in the car and drive out to where they found the tracks?
100%, yes, yeah. But it depends, because mostly we find the tracks in the bush. Then I call my dog, then I kiss him. Yeah, I romance him. I give him water, yeah, so that he can work.
You romance him, I love that.
Yes, yeah. So from there, then I put the harness, I put the leash, because you got the backup of maybe 6 people at the back, but you're always in the front. So but you're afraid because you're always in danger.
Yeah, because so you're the first person in between the poachers and the rest of the people behind you.
Always I'm the one who first see the poachers. And sometimes they run away. Sometimes I find them sleeping. If the poachers is plus minus 60 meters, they come to me and climb with the front leg here. I tell them, guys, organize the helicopter because the poachers are around. They say, are you sure? I said, yes, I know this dog. Then they organize the helicopter. They organize some field rangers to close everything everywhere.
Wow, so the closer the dog gets to the poachers, the more it's coming to you to say, like, we're close, we're close, we're close.
So,
but what about when you catch a poacher? How does that feel for you?
You know, when you come across that the situation that you find a poacher, obviously, at the moment, you will feel, like, nervous, but later you will feel happy because the main aim of tracking at the end want to catch the poachers. But when we see them, obviously we'll be nervous. But at the end, happy.
The dog handlers lead the search party and will often be the first eyes on the poachers if the team is successful in tracking them down. The dogs and their handlers work almost symbiotically. They have an intimate shorthand. Right now, leading the charge on the ground, there are 5 rangers on the follow-up team with the tracking dog, and then 16 other rangers circling the area, patrolling. There are 2 vehicles being used, 2 helicopters on standby, and more running hounds ready and waiting.
The cost of a day's operation is enormous. And then it happens that you get 2 or 3 and even 4 operations in a day, you know, so you must imagine the cost.
Greg tells me that some of the men from Mozambique who enter the Kruger to poach carry enough food and other supplies to stay in the park for up to 4 days.
But we've had groups in for up to 5 days and still not actually find a rhino. So that does happen.
Especially now that there's so many less rhinos to be found, it's much harder.
No, absolutely, yeah.
Later that afternoon, the tracking team believes the poaching group is not too far from where they are. Everyone is standing by with the helicopters ready to go. When the section ranger, Niels, makes the call, they'll be deployed.
How do you feel regardless, like heading out to what we're about to do?
The prospect of catching these guys, that would be a good day. That's our mission and our goal. So I'd be absolutely delighted. It means, firstly, that these guys they're going to be taken out of the system themselves. They'd be charged criminally and they end up in having to appear in court and imprisoned for the duration of that whole process before they're even sentenced. You always try to remove a firearm out of the system. It's a huge amount of value placed on firearms for poaching and the poaching syndicates. If we do seize a firearm, we may get forensic evidence from other crime scenes that relate to that firearm. So then that forms part of the investigation. And if there's a match with that firearm related to other scenes, then that would obviously be brought into the criminal charges. And then obviously if we can get a group before they shoot a rhino, we're effectively saving a rhino.
Obviously going into something like this, there is a high chance that someone could get hurt, probably most likely on the poaching side of things. Does that enter your mind in anticipation?
We operate on a minimum force basis. Our constitution doesn't allow anything more than minimum or equal force. Obviously, on the ground, the reality is we're up against armed poachers. They're quite capable of retaliation with a firearm. I think subconsciously we understand there is the possibility of a firefight. It's definitely within the ranks if we can make an arrest of all the poachers and recover the firearm without having fired a shot, then that's first prize, definitely first prize. A good proportion of the time you actually walk into poachers when they are resting and they're sitting still and they're able to actually hear you coming. You know, they're able to sit in a position, effectively an ambush situation. There's circumstances where poachers have been injured and killed in the process.
Would there be times where you maybe have felt that it wasn't justified?
I think so. Perhaps so. That's putting me on the spot now. You know that. I think there's been occasions when the team on the ground's been overzealous, or it's not really the right word, but sort of excessive. Excessive. But I think it is completely understandable when you've been following a group for an entire day in high heat you're tired and you do get fatigued and you're on edge for the entire duration. There's no sort of, it's not like you're walking and relaxing. You are literally on edge, scanning, projecting, anticipating something to happen.
Kruger Park is a beast. It's not your friend.
Here's Ken again, the head ranger of the Kruger.
You know, it's huge. The park is 2 million hectares. It's the same size as Belgium, if not bigger. It's almost the same shape as Israel and size of Israel. So, you know, applying technologies, applying tactics, it's difficult. I mean, we have, the other day, 53 degrees centigrade was measured in the bush by one of the rangers. So you have high temperatures, there is humidity, and in the winter, it does go down to zero. And it's remote. There are a lot of challenges. And of course, there's wild animals, big game, elephants, lions, leopard, buffalo, hippo, all of which also contribute to the risks in the environment that you're dealing with. They're out there every day, in the heat, at night, in the sun, in the wind, in the rain. That's the first thing. Second thing is that it's relentless. It's continuous. It doesn't stop. In a war situation, troops are rotated to the front for a period of time, and then they rotate it back. That doesn't happen here. The only time you're off is if you're off for the day or you've taken leave. There's no regular deployment to the front. Do your stuff, come back, spend time with family. The other thing is, day in and day out, seeing dead animals chopped up. And when I say chopped up, many animals, that their horns have been chopped off, they've been knocked down with a heavy caliber round. The thing is still alive. The thing gets up and starts walking around. All of us have been witness to that. And some more than others, because they're in the areas where a lot of the poaching is taking place on a relentless basis. So you're seeing that all the time. You're also being deprived of the fact that you can spend time with family. You're living in a small tent or outside of a tent. Tracking for 40 kilometers or 30 kilometers. People are tired. People are emotional. It has the recipe for all sorts of issues, psychological. A few of our colleagues have had 3 contacts in one day. This is a counterinsurgency campaign out here, very similar. And the guys haven't been trained for it. They're evolving into it. It is so complex, just the psychological aspects of it. Because it's relentless, it's been going on now at this rate since 2007, 2008. Relentless, doesn't stop, not for one moment.
I'm a clinical psychologist. In 2011, I was approached by one of the managers here because of the shift in the job description, really, of the field ranger, where they now have to fight the guerrilla war against rhino poaching, and the field rangers were not trained as soldiers. So when they wounded or killed a poacher, it had a really profound effect on them. And to also comply with a firearms law where they have to be debriefed after armed contact. So I was very fortunate to be brought in. So that is why you find me here under this tree.
Ratia is a clinical psychologist hired by the park to buffer the psychological strain of the conservation efforts. She routinely supports the rangers and is called in additionally when a contact has been made in the field. We're sitting under a tree at the rangers' headquarters in Skukuza, which is right under the flight path for the small planes that bring in tourists, those who can afford flights into the park. It's also where the helicopters are deployed from.
The rules of engagement in firing at a person is totally different to rules of engagement when there's a problem animal. So it's a totally different type of training that they've had to undergo. Some took to it like a duck to water. They liked that power. And others who are perhaps more gentle by nature have found that quite difficult. I deal with the field rangers in the same way, I hope, as they have grown up with verbal carryover of information, the narrative approach, asking them to tell me the story. The Shangaan are brilliant trackers, and to tell them, tell me the story of tracking this person, and then focusing a lot on the sensory experiences. What did you smell? What did you see? What did you hear? Taking them again away from that to shift the narrative. You deal with the trauma, but also you shift the narrative to something where there was no trauma. Somehow we've managed to merge the Western therapeutic necessities that they are compelled to undergo for the Firearms Act with the tribal approach. So I'm really trying to develop that using the narrative approach.
Storytelling is the foundation of Ratea's treatment of the rangers. Storytelling used therapeutically.
How's it, Greg?
Niels, how's it, man?
All right, yourself.
Okay, cool.
They just above you, just at Makasolo turnoff. They're coming straight back to Makasolo turnoff.
Is
I
it?
Think these oaks have jumped the tar road again.
You think so?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
I'm also coming that side.
Okay. All right.
Station 3 off.
Okay, man. All right. Ciao.
Niels is still leading the patrol. He's across the dirt road looking into the thick bush, his brow furrowed, deep in thought as he paces back and forth. From what I've heard, he's a respected leader of his team, much of whom are still standing by for him to make the call, based on the little and changing information. It's a boiling hot day and his team are getting tired. Plus, when the sun is blaring from above like it is now, it's much harder to make out the tracks because there are no shadows on the sand. While we're waiting, I asked Niels about his experience of the crisis.
I've been in the park here since 95. Poaching only started late 2000, 2008, 2009. Really, really kind of increased from there. Mm. Intensity has changed quite a bit. We would have lost a couple of carcasses a year and you had follow-ups. We always had poaching follow-up, whether it was meat poaching or fish poaching. Or since the park is here and you've got animals, you'll always have bushmeat trade. Where on the western side, you know, you've got a big community of people that are living close proximity to the park, so always be a bushmeat trade.
Mm.
Now it's become more organized, you know, and high-tech. Guys come in with big rifles, modern bolt-action, big calibers, 375, 458. Calibers intended for just hunting big game. And the guys that you're dealing with is extremely well. You'll see now when you visit Mozambique and you look at the poverty in those communities and stuff like that. There's no work, so they aren't. It's just a natural skill to have. That's the way the guys grown up.
So it sounds like you have a bit of understanding and empathy for why they're doing it.
You do understand it at some point, but communities get abused by, you know, people from outside. Those are the ones that's really a problem.
Yeah, the next level up from the poacher.
The next level is basically people get exploited, you know, Mozambicans get exploited. At some point one must realise that, you know, you're also part of a community and you're also part of your own community there. If the guys were not greedy, then, you know, stuff would not happen. I mean, if you look at crossing an international boundary with a firearm, it's almost like an act of war. And most of these people that are involved in the thing doesn't do it once or twice. Once they're in and doing it, the guy tend to do it until he gets either caught or maybe killed in one of the contacts. Mm. You know, so it's just one of the sad stories of Africa, I think. Greg, I'm going to give it another 10 minutes or so, then I'm going to get to a phone or, where, you know, the place where I can just check whether, you know, what is happening.
I think it's been an hour now.
But they won't give up, I'll know they must find it.
As is always the case, the poachers are players in a larger operating system, the syndicates. Some of the conservation team believe that the poachers' motivations are plainly insidious. Others tend to think their actions are more morally complex, hard to make out clearly, kind of like the poachers themselves, hidden in the bush.
Shoulder height and maybe even up towards the house.
Okay, so we've been sitting listening to the cricket for a little bit, waiting for news, and no news has come. So what do you think is going on?
So what's happened is the guys have lost the tracks. They lost them. It's been more than an hour now. Even if we were to find the tracks now.
39,
excuse me. At 39, I'm standing by. 39, I'm standing by, Niels.
That day the poachers slipped out. No gunshots were heard, and therefore there was no way of knowing if they'd hunted a rhino or not. It all felt a little surreal, being on the verge of a potential contact one minute and the next driving home for dinner. The day was oddly fun, chatting with Greg and joking around. The reality of what we were doing there felt distant. It was anticlimactic. The conservation efforts all seem quite palatable in the abstract, and it's easy to feel detached when you're partially existing in a utopian dream, slowing down to the gentle hum of the cicadas, no digital distractions, waking and sleeping with the sun, watching the wild spaces breathe. A few days after those poachers had left, late in the afternoon, Greg gets a phone call. One of his rangers has found the carcass of a rhino.
This is a young animal. It's a young white rhino. The likelihood that it actually has been shot, is wounded, is run. It's run here and died here. Obviously the poachers never managed to recover the horns. Use a metal detector to try and pick up, you know, a bullet head. Anything to suggest that it was wounded. Often, especially guys when they're shooting at night, they with a silencer, the accuracy is not very good, so it does happen a fair amount of the time that an animal's been shot and we find it days later, you know, either seriously wounded or dead.
So how long do you think that he's been here for?
This is 2 to 3 days. What we do now is we take obviously the location. The guys are taking a GPS coordinates there. Mm-hmm. They'll describe it. James is the one who found it. He provides an initial statement to open an inquiry at the police. Following the investigation, we'll determine whether it's either a poached animal, or if we can't determine whether it's a poached animal, we'll call it an unknown, died of unknown cause. That doesn't mean it wasn't poached, it just means we can't determine it. But if there's any evidence to be gathered, we'll find it. And if it is a poached animal, then it actually becomes a criminal case.
Because the horns are still on it, does that mean you need to take them off, like, immediately?
Yeah, we do. If we find a carcass with horns on, the person who finds it assumes a responsibility. So in this case, James assumes a responsibility.
Why is that?
It's because of the value. Imagine coming across that. I mean, the value of those two horns there is enormous. That front horn, maybe 1.5 kilograms. Back horn, maybe 300 or 400 grams.
Damien Carrington wrote for The Guardian. Key wildlife trade groups declined to detail the current price of rhino horn for fear of encouraging more crime. However, the information seems freely exchanged within the region in which the crime is committed. A rhino's horn sells for approximately $65,000 per kilo, and a horn can be up to 4 kilos heavy.
It's like coming across two big golden nuggets. I mean, anyone will pick them up. We have to remove the horn.
Just a quick warning, what you're about to hear is pretty graphic and may be confronting for some listeners. At this point, James, the ranger who was on duty who came across the carcass, begins hacking at the front of the rhino's face. I'd expected the horns to come off easier, but it looks like hard work.
Oh, rhino blood on me.
The thumping sound reminds me of chopping wood. This is the biggest dead animal I've ever seen. Its rib cage is still intact, but the rest of its body has been devoured by scavengers. There's bits of skin and meat strewn around where the hyenas and vultures would have been earlier in the day. It stinks, and the dead beast is swarming with flies. They've now got the horns off, and James is taking photos on his phone for evidence.
51219.
They take down the GPS coordinates. It's over? You're finished?
We won't find any evidence. This animal wasn't shot here, so there's no evidence to be found other than possibly a bullet head in the body.
Washing their hands. It turns out Greg was right. Later we found out this rhino was killed by poachers. The investigators found 2 bullets inside the carcass. They'd obviously shot the animal, but it wasn't immediately fatal. She'd run away and died days later. The poachers themselves were never located.
Does that feel worse to you, that they shot it and didn't get it, didn't kill it?
Yeah, it's a waste, completely wasted. Imagine the suffering and the pain that that animal's going through before it died. Yeah, it is worse.
Is there any sort of satisfaction, maybe not the right word, but of the fact that they didn't get the horns?
Yeah, I guess it's a small consolation, you know, if you want to call it that, but at the same time, it's an animal that's dead, you know, and not a pleasant, quick, sudden death. Obviously long and painful and lingering. Yeah.
Stink bug.
No, they're terrible.
I'm back.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
It was late when we got home. Ben and Sophia were already asleep in bed. Tam was waiting for us, having a beer and listening to the sounds of the bush at night.
Basically, I was just wanting to ask you what sort of happened for you after we were all sitting by the pool, hanging out, having a beer, end of the day, feeling relaxed, and then Greg gets a call. Can you kind of just talk me through what happened from there, from your perspective?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of very normal. I mean, you kind of get used to it. You need to just slot in and get things going because you never know when he's going to get back. And yeah, so got the kids ready, finished cooking supper, which he was supposed to do tonight.
Yeah, because tonight was Greg's cooking night, so we were all putting our feet up about it.
Instructions as to what I needed to finish, and finished it up and got the kids bathed and into bed. And yeah,
how do the kids go with that? Are they pretty used to it?
Yeah, completely used to it. Yeah, they'll pretty much. Yeah. They didn't actually really even... Oh, they did. They asked where Dad was going, and they told him, and then they just get on with it. But yeah, I'm there, so yeah.
Thanks, Dad.
Oh, gosh. Okay. I'm not very good at these things.
No, you're great. You're great.
I felt proud to be connected to this family, my family, and inspired by the life that they lead, a life in service to a noble cause. Waking up at the crack of dawn each morning felt easier knowing I was supporting a fight for something, something big and worthwhile. A planet full of natural wonders, preserved for future generations to enjoy. But the longer I clung to this interpretation of the facts alone, the longer I clung, like the dry, dusty earth covering my sweaty face at the end of each day, the dirtier I felt. As I spoke to more people in the Kruger, a murkier truth began to unveil. If Nelson Mandela was right when he said, "Where you stand depends on where you sit," what window was I sitting at? And who was framing the view?
Invisible Hand was co-created and written by Georgina Savage and Sophie Side in partnership with Case File Presents. It was produced and edited by Georgina Savage. Research and narration written by Sophie Side. Graphic design by Marco Vuleta Djukanov. History segments written by Max Favetti and performed by Seth Kruger. Original score, sound design, and soundtrack by me, Issa Williams. Archival material used in this episode was sourced from CNN, CBS Evening News, ABC News USA, Associated Press, and CGTN Africa.